Hello and welcome to the Ad Fontes podcast. My name is Ansi Kamel. I am an editor at large at the journal Ad Fontes, and I'm joined as always by my two co-hosts, Colin Chan Redimer, the poetry editor of Ad Fontes, and Reese Laverty, the senior editor of the entire operation. Gentlemen, it's great to see you again.
Heyo.
Good to be with you.
So today we decided that we're going to do something a little bit different from what we normally do, which is
it's a classic podcast has nothing left to talk about. We're clearly done talking to each other. Please tell us what to talk about.
In that sense, it is like what we normally do, in that we are poorly prepared, and this time we've just phoned it in and outsourced it.
We're even less well prepared today than usual, because today we are doing a podcast in an Ask Me Anything format, and Reese did not send us the questions ahead of time, so we've all got them pulled up right in front of us right now.
They've all just been generated by ChatGPT. No one responded.
No, it's from Twitter and from our subscriber Discord, actually, our subscriber/donor Discord. So if you want to be in the Discord, Reese, maybe we can make that our spotlight.
Yeah, become a donor to
become a donor to get on the.
It's not available to Ad Fontes subscribers. It was back in the day, but there's just so many of you guys. We had to make it even more exclusive. So Ad Fontes and Davenant donors.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to just rotate choosing questions that we want to answer. So sorry if you're listening to this and your question doesn't get answered. It just kind of sucked. And, you know, that's no one's fault, but we're just not going to answer it. So, all right, let's get us going. Colin, you want to get us going here? Do you want to pick a question?
Yeah, well, Ansi, what's your issue with C.S. Lewis?
Oh, I was hoping someone would ask me
that's
that.
That's the one I would have chosen if you'd asked me first.
No, okay, so what's my issue with C.S. Lewis? That was the entire question, by the way. Mm-hmm. What's Ansi's issue with C.S. Lewis?
It's a great question.
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess it would be a good question if I had an issue with C.S. Lewis, but I don't. So I don't think
about you at all.
what I have an issue with is C.S. Lewis fanboys. All right. So here's what I mean. Right. C.S. Lewis was a really brilliant, like, popular writer on Christian. I mean, he was a brilliant academic too. But like when evangelicals talk about C.S. Lewis, most of the time they're talking about his popular level public-facing works of apologetics and fiction and so forth. And I really like all that stuff. Like, I love Mere Christianity. I liked the Space Trilogy well enough. You know, I think The Great Divorce is, you know, phenomenal. Mm. Everyone loves The Chronicles of Narnia. So, you know, I have no problem with C.S. Lewis. What I do have a problem with is treating C.S. Lewis like an authority, rather than as a fellow modern Christian with whom we should be in conversation, right? So that I think what my problem with Lewis is actually more the posture that a lot of evangelicals take to Lewis, where they think that he's like,
where they dress up in tweed and start drinking tea before 8 a.m., even though they're Americans.
Is that what you're doing, Colin, right now?
Maybe.
He was specifically late so that he wasn't doing it before right. 8 a.m.
That's right. No, but so I don't know. Does that make sense? It's not actually It's not actually about C.S. Lewis himself. It's about the kind of authority with which he's sort of imbued by a lot of contemporary American evangelicals who don't really know enough to know where C.S. Lewis is faithfully representing the tradition or where he's genuinely modern. And actually, those are kind of my favorite moments when Lewis is sort of like a genuine, like acting as a modern in his engagement with the tradition, or where he's frankly idiosyncratic. Mm. So on some of his theological views, he's just idiosyncratic. And he'll tell you this himself. I mean, the guy said, like, look, I'm not a theologian. I don't do theology. I'm a Christian.
Oh, that was just such a posture. That was just a complete lie.
All I know is that I don't know anything. Yeah.
The only time he tried to do theology, he got wrecked by Anscombe. Okay, so like he's not a theologian. He's a brilliant,
that wasn't even really
popular,
theology,
pious Christian,
which is kind of Anscombe's point.
It was philosophy or whatever it was. I don't know what it was.
Right, I'm just saying.
First philosophy.
You're reminding me of these evangelicals who kind of do a superficial reading of Lewis, and they sort of claim that they know who he is, and then they can reject him because they're like, ah, he's not all that smart. But then they don't even know about the Anscombe debate, you know, and what, which paragraph in Miracles it was that they were arguing about, and the fact that Lewis agreed that she was right and then amended the book.
Oh, yeah. No, and then he never tried to write that sort of thing again, right? I mean, that's the, you know.
The question is why. Yeah. Anyway, this is us being in the weeds. You're a little bit, you know, you're a little bit of the snooty academic. You graduated from Lewis. This is the operating theory that I have for why you hate Lewis. If I was asked, why does Anzi hate Lewis, you know, I might give a different genealogy of the hate.
Why do I hate Lewis? Why do I hate
Reese,
Lewis?
Why does he hate Lewis?
Well, let's talk about Anzi, not to Anzi.
That's right, Reese. Let's talk about Anzi. You can just drop off the podcast for a minute.
Yeah. I've wondered about our good friend. If it's because he's not from the same kind of normie evangelical background in which Lewis is. You just breathe Lewis in that kind of way. I say breathe him, not really deeply breathe him. Like, he's just kind of gobbets and quotes, and the same quotes turn up in sermons, you know, again and again. And
oh, but Narnia I think he is from that sort of normie evangelical Americanism.
Honestly,
that is exactly my background.
Yeah.
Well, it's like
I feel like he's reacting against it. He's trying to sort of get away from these, you know, backwoods evangelicals, and he wants to sort of. Because this is the truth, as somebody who has represented Lewis in the Academy and says, I actually think he's really brilliant, you get a lot of reactions if you try to wear the Lewis sticker outside of evangelicalism and into, you know, normal academia. Because people know lots of folks who, to Anzi's point, who've done a sort of poor reading or a thin reading.
Mm-hmm.
They've got what, as you said, right, the little pull quotes from sermons in their back pockets, and you have to recognize Lewis is this whole philosophical project behind him. Once you're in touch with that, then you realize, holy shnikes, this guy really knows his stuff.
I share Anzi's kind of irritation now with the way Lewis is sort of used, and maybe I'll get over this and be like, that's cool. Let there be the popular Lewis, but like as someone who, it's cool, yeah. But you kind of grow up with you know Narnia Lewis as a small child, then you discover Lewis the fiction writer. Then you meet Lewis the apologist as a teenager, and he just is, you know, super helpful for either kind of bringing you into the faith, or for me it was I discovered Lewis kind of then post hoc, you know, did the apologetics after I'd been converted. Then maybe I came to a phase where I was a bit like, everybody talks about Lewis, you know, what's the big deal? He's a smart guy. But then you kind of, then you push further. Then I think I did English as an undergrad and discovered Lewis, the literary scholar. I'm like, oh, this was actually the guy's day job and he knows his stuff.
Right.
And then you were kind of pushed through into what I might call Lewis, the philosopher, with, as Colin has said, this just whole kind of Christian Platonist influenced project going on.
The four loves, the abolition of man, like all that. Even Till We Have Faces is a little bit, it's not like his other fiction.
It's the best novel.
Yeah. No, I guess
keep it snappy.
Yeah. All right. So that's my thing.
So
I don't have a problem. Lewis.
If you're the person who asked the question, Anzi's issue isn't with C.S. Lewis, it's clearly with people like you.
Whereas I am here to defend you from him.
Colin, like, pretends he puts on the airs of the plebes, but he's not a plebe. Colin, you're wearing tweed right now. Who's wearing a hoodie, Colin? Who's wearing a hoodie right now?
Isn't that a Kanye West hoodie?
It is. It's a Yeezy hoodie.
Wow.
It's a Yeezy Gap hoodie. Back when Gap looked like it was actually going to turn a profit. But anyway, that's a story for another time. All right, Reese. Let's do a question.
Throw a question.
Yeah, sure. There's one particularly directed at Colin. So we've had one particularly directed at Anzi. None particularly directed at me, which either means that I have no discernible opinions of my own or that people like me. One for Colin. Colin, regarding working in a predominantly Catholic environment, what are the theological and philosophical challenges that you see the most as a Protestant, and how do you navigate those without falling into a position of antagonism with your employer and colleagues?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wish I worked in a predominantly Catholic environment, would be my first question, my first response. And that actually really helps. So I do think I would have a different experience. I have a good friend who left the college that I teach at to work at Thomas Aquinas College in Southern California, which is a very devout, pious Roman Catholic College that does liberal artsy, great books things. I imagine what it would be like working there would be quite different than where I work. And so where I work, when he was here at St. Mary's, I don't talk a lot about my employer on the podcast, but there's a question about it. So talk about St. Mary's. You know, that he would say, and all of the Roman Catholics that I know who are sort of practicing Roman Catholics will say that they themselves feel sort of embattled. They feel like they're being expected to uphold some sort of institutional history that most of the institution doesn't really want anymore. But then they get kind of trotted out. Like I have one friend who's who says that she gets trotted out when they need a Catholic.
Is that Anne Carpenter said that on Twitter? A couple weeks ago, actually.
She talks about it constantly. Yeah, so I guess it is public knowledge. So this is Anne Carpenter, who's a good friend of mine, and she just, you know, she just, they kind of wheel her in, and she says the Catholic thing, and then they wheel her out before they, you know, respond, because they don't want her to hear what they really have to say. So, yeah, I think, in my experience, in the situation that I'm in, it's quite easy because it's very much, you know, the ecumenism of the trenches or whatever. And there's just so much more that I'm in agreement with that kind of Catholic contingent than the majority of the institution. I will say it then gets a little bit tricky because I'm in a department that tends to have mostly those traditional practicing Roman Catholics and then myself in this kind of, old, you know, ex-Marxist, who's an interesting fellow himself. And there, I think I feel a little bit more of what this question seems to be getting at, which is, you know, I was just at the philosophy defenses for the students, and then we had this kind of philosophy hangout after party thing. Faculty and the students are all together letting their hair down. And, you know, they're just going on and on about how, well, you know, the problem with Protestantism is, there's all these denominations, and if you don't like the way that, you know, your church is going, yeah, you just start a new church, you start a new denomination. It's always, you know, there's all this energy, they're starting new things. Whereas the Catholics, but then of course, I would say the good Catholics will acknowledge their own problems. They'll say, whereas the Catholics, you know, if there's a problem with our church, we just go to sleep. We just sleep through the problem. We just pretend, you know, like ostriches, that there is no problem. So I think having a sense of humor, Just as with any sort of set of differences, having a sense of humor about yourself, trying to cultivate and allow space for them to have a sense of humor about their thing, from normal social interactions is probably best. And then, you know, I have a policy in class as well as just in my work on campus that we did have to sign a document saying we were going to uphold the Catholic understanding of the human person or something. And I take that very seriously. So I try my best not to undermine the Roman Catholic Church's position on anything, and I will explain their position to students if I'm asked. But I also make a deal with my students that I say, you know, I think part of good pedagogy is to have a no BS policy. If you ask me a direct question, I'm going to give you a direct answer. And so I will have students who will ask me, well, you know, what do you think about this, professor? Like, you've told us this thing, you know, about the Roman Catholic Church. And then I will respond, and I'll tell them, you know, here's what I think. But, you know, I'm not here primarily and predominantly, they're not paying me to turn you into little Protestants. So, you know, I'm hired to do a job on one level. And part of that job is to think and to learn and to teach. And part of that job is to explicitly, you know, teach people about the Catholic understanding of the human person, in one way, shape or form. There's a lot of overlap between that Protestantism.
Right. I was just going to say, I mean, that's been one of our Davenant's things, like, for a very long time, is that, like, you know, genuine sort of confessional Protestantism is Catholic. And Catholicism in, you know, in its, you know, discussion of nature, human nature and so forth, is also Catholic, you know, and so we actually, like, share.
Yeah. And when you get into the Catholic communion, and we've said this before, too, in those same episodes, you end up seeing that they don't agree with themselves about all kinds of stuff. There's all these fractures,
all sorts of internal diversity.
And so you have to sort of, it's really, I think that's why in large public and broad stroke settings, try to have a sense of humor about yourself, try to encourage and cultivate a sense of humor and maybe even poke a little bit to see if you can get them laughing, you know, at their own foibles. And then when it gets into the kind of nitty gritty of argumentation, I mean, you know, you all have met my department chair, you know, the the arguments aren't so dissimilar to the arguments that I would have with a Lutheran or even with somebody in my own church who I feel like is not articulating the truths of Christianity well enough. So I don't know. That's my big picture sense of it. Anzi, do you have one of these questions that you want to pick out? Go ahead.
Well, no, I was gonna aim this one at Reese actually, even though in parentheses Reese said this is all the hosts.
I feel left out.
But I am the host, so I'm gonna override that. Reese, I have a question for you. Pretend you get to develop a curriculum for the lay person on the classics, and you can define the classics however you want. It can be literature, philosophy, theology, whatever. What do you put on the curriculum? You're like one of the few people on this podcast that has experience teaching lay people on a regular basis in your church. Yeah. So how do you, you want to get them exposed to the classics. What do you teach them?
Gosh, well, I'm gonna guess this is, by layperson we mean an adult. We've had words on this podcast recently about whether you teach things from the classical world, Plato, philosophy, to young people in classical Christian education. I'm guessing that's not what this is asking, since it's using the term layperson. Well, I'll maybe, I did an English undergrad, which was basically a degree in critical theory, which I'm very grateful for now, 10 years later. But it took me a few years out of university to realize I knew nothing about literature. So any knowledge of the classics I've had has been either self-taught or, to be honest, through coming into the wonderful orbit of the Davenant Institute. So what would I put in there? You start with Homer. I don't see any way around doing that. You move. If it's for the layperson, I think you skip the pre-Socratics and just start with a couple of Platonic dialogues. I don't know if you want to start with shorter ones, like the Meno or something like that, which is a personal favourite, or if you go for the big guns, like Republican Symposium. I don't know that much about Roman philosophy, but you'd probably want to throw in, I don't know, Marcus Aurelius or somebody like that to give a Roman flavour.
Plutarch, right? I mean,
Plutarch, Lives, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's like Greek, right? But he's writing in the Roman Empire, so I think so. Somebody will correct me. We'll get angry emails from our classics wing.
Classicist nerds. I'd start there. Are we in any disagreement? That and then maybe we'll say we're up to the birth of Christ. And you guys can start helping me out from here. Or do you take issue with where I start? Homer, the Socratics, a little bit of the Romans.
No. I mean, I think it's interesting because that would be the... That would definitely be the standard answer for the last 100 years. I'm intrigued by people who want to say Genesis. So if what you just articulated is sort of what I've thought for most of my life, there's sort of a new thought that's been growing in my mind ever since we did that the book on reforming classical education, that like actually maybe. Maybe we start with Genesis. Maybe the fundamentalists had it right all along,
You know what's interesting, though? So I did a core sequence when I was in college, and the very first day the professor said, in this core sequence, we are going to be learning from two cities, Jerusalem and Athens. We started with the Apology, and then we went right to Genesis.
Was Straussian at Chicago? I assume
she was not. Okay. I don't think so. She did like a comp lit degree at Harvard. But she was like super into Freud and loved Augustine. Very interesting person. I kind of like that bipole approach, because you kind of you get to or maybe we started with it was the Apology, then Genesis, and then we did Homer after that. So we didn't like do it chronologically exactly, but it was kind of nice because you got a feel for the differences between like a Hebraic thought world and a Greek thought world. And then in the second quarter, you were kind of in Western Christendom.
Yeah. I mean, the first week of my English undergrad was a module called Beginnings, and you sort of went through key texts up to like, I think, Frankenstein or something like that in the kind of start of science fiction. And the first week was, creation and flood myths, including Genesis, Noah, and then Gilgamesh and Atrahasis and stuff like that. I guess I'll take the question to see the classics. Maybe this is. If I imagine myself schooling a Christian layperson who, let's say, will already know Genesis in kind of the non-Christian classics.
Right.
But it's a different question then. Do you want to, you know, this isn't how you would most principally present what Genesis and, say, the Torah as a whole is to somebody, but you can say, as well as being, you know, the Word of God written to them for you, and living and active for you now, this is also a classic text, foundational to Western society, and let's consider it as that. And I get that would be worthwhile, I guess.
I think the argument for why you should learn this stuff, because we've run a bunch of articles recently. There's this whole dust up going on about the classical learning test, and I just put something up on American Reformer, and we've had a couple articles go through Ed Fontes. My position is going to be, the reason why you want the people in your church to learn Aristotle's virtue ethics is because this is something that Christian theology has been developing around and sometimes in opposition to for thousands of years. And so similarly, right, the ancient Greek myths, you want to learn the myths of these people because these are the stories people left when they decided to come to the gospel. So it's not like we need to give them this because it's going to save them. I've probably said this before, but it's one of the things that I learned from my Catholic department that I teach in that has stuck with me most. We don't technically as the church need the liberal arts. We don't technically as the church need classical education at all. It's not essential to the mission of the church, to the advancement of the gospel. But the church has always found it very helpful to keep this stuff nearby. And that's really why we would do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to that extent, then, I think you would want to throw in some of the most classic and enduring articulations of the pagan myths, Hesiod and...
I was just going to say Hesiod. Yeah. I for whatever reason, I can't bring myself to really care that much about, the Phoenician or non-Hebrew Semitic myths. I just whatever.
They're just not as cool, Ansi. That's why.
No, it's I mean, it's fine. I don't know, but once you get to Hesiod, it's there's something about Hesiod putting Hesiod into conversation with Genesis, which is just really productive, and you can sort of see how, where the similarities and differences are, and how that impacts our understanding of human beings and so forth. So I don't know, but Hesiod is you got to put Hesiod on there.
Anzi, speaking of classical texts and whatnot, do Protestants need more of Thomas Aquinas, or have we had enough? That's a question we got, and that is a very relevant
question
right now.
Yeah, but anyway, so this is something though that I've been thinking about for a while. Do we need more Thomas Aquinas? I guess it depends on what you mean by that. So I think for
who's
a lot of evangelicals...
Which Aquinas?
Right. I mean, I think for a lot of evangelicals...
It's just how we're going to answer
we
all
need...
of these questions.
Who's X?
Your questions
Which
aren't
y?
Good enough for us to answer. Go bring
Puny
us
listeners.
Better questions.
I was about to answer.
Sorry, Ian.
But yeah,
go ahead.
I think for a lot of evangelical Protestants who, so I should put it this way. I mean, I think the theologians in the mainline never really lost Thomas Aquinas, the sort of Orthodox or Orthodox-ish theologians in the mainline are still doing a ton of stuff with Thomas. I mean, the Angelicum, which is the Dominican sort of, university college in Rome, just invited a bunch of Protestants and did a big ecumenical conference on Thomas, and so pretty much everyone was conversant in Thomas. I think there's a big debate right now happening in evangelical Protestant circles, particularly focused, it seems like, in the Baptists and certain pockets of the Reformed world. And I think for a lot of those folks, recovering Thomas Aquinas really just means recovering kind of post-Aristotelian classical theology, And I think that, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, you know, it's a good thing to know how Aristotle is integrated into the West and what that does for medieval theology and for the, you know, Reformed Orthodox and so forth. So I like, you know, insofar as that's what, you know, recover Thomas Aquinas means, I think that's fine. I think it's good generally, broadly, but if what we mean by recover Thomas Aquinas is like, we want to recover the Thomas Aquinas who's engaged in, you know, kind of polemical conversations against the Franciscans, and who, you know, is doing very particular things with, like, Arabic philosophy.
I'm very concerned about the Albigensians, personally. I just, I wake up at night and I think about how about they're influencing my hot dog church that I love, and I gotta get rid of them.
Yeah, but,
and Aquinas,
but I guess that's what I'm saying.
He knows how to deal with the Albigensians.
That's what I'm saying, though, right? You know, it's that there's a kind of, like, Thomas as a stand-in for, you know, a sort of broad and diverse and amorphous theological tradition, and, like, Thomas is a very helpful entry point, that's great. No problem with that. But if you mean, like, recover Thomas Aquinas in this sort of fuller, in this sort of, like, more fully orbed way, then I mean, I guess I just wonder, like, why you're focusing on Thomas as opposed to, like, recovering the entire medieval and post-medieval Catholic scholastic tradition or something, you know,
because that sounds harder.
Right, but that's what's responsible, right? I mean, like, so that's the thing. It's like, it depends on what your goal is.
Yeah, well, much like we said with Lewis, it's we're possibly at a stage with the Protestant recovery of Aquinas, whatever that means, where one can kind of rattle his name off in a certain circle and it'll kind of have a desired effect, and it will bring with it an air of authority, and kind of that's that. Whereas what people like our venerable colleague Ryan will want to say is that there's a lot in there. There's a dense project going on, and if you're going to try and sort of trot out the Thomas card, don't do that in a way that suggests you've got a firm grasp on his whole project, when actually you don't. Now, that's not to say that, like, you need to be a full expert in everything to be able to use it constructively, but we're at a curious stage with how kind of Thomas says lands among Protestants.
But it's a kind of a, even your articulation of it's kind of a strange argument, because when I hear people talk about Thomas Aquinas, I tend to hear them talking about Thomas Aquinas saying some particular thing, as opposed to, like, I guess maybe I just don't run in the kinds of circles to do this, but I'm sure they're out there. People who are like, having read all of Thomas Aquinas, here's what he thinks. In fact, I only know one person who speaks this way.
Yeah.
And I guess Ryan heard himself. And he may or may not actually have read all of Thomas Aquinas. He seems to have, from where I sit. So,
I just think that there's, like, a bunch of different conversations happening. Mm. And I think, you know, one of those conversations is in the kind of evangelical Baptist world. And they really do often speak like that, where it's like, we need to recover the tradition. And then the tradition is, like, you know, supposed to be Thomas Aquinas. But actually, like, the tradition becomes, like, the, you know,
Who was declared a heretic for a while.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, so I don't know. I'm just sort of ambivalent about the
Jesus,
whole conversation.
Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, and then Billy Graham. Billy.
Yeah.
I think,
so I don't know.
C.S.
I'm
Lewis
happy for people to read Thomas.
Let's be honest.
I think also some people, when they talk about retrieving it, they also mean, like, kind of Thomas's method in, like, people will be... And it's a helpful exercise to be like, write out like a sed contra kind of, you know, objection one, objection two, objection three, respondeo, sed contra, reply to objection one. You know, that's a helpful intellectual exercise that will just make people sort of, you know, use their rational faculty more than they do in almost any kind of, you know, university program they get put through. But like, that's not the only way to do theology. And it's sort of as tantalizing and slightly exotic as it is to think, oh, maybe if we didn't write systematics, instead we did, you know, a sort of question and response summa, maybe our theology would be better. And like, that's just not evident to me that's necessarily the case.
Yeah. Now, I should say, I think we are not representative of the Davenant Institute on this point. I think the three of us are kind of outliers here, but you know, I think if we brought some of our colleagues on, they'd be like, yes, everyone needs more Thomas maximally all the time. And that's great. You know, Davenant's a diverse organization. All right, Reese, your turn to choose a question.
Yeah, me. I like this one. What is modernity? Does it actually exist? Or are we just exaggerating our distance from the ancients? I like this one.
It absolutely exists. I'm
what is it, Colin?
What is it is trickier. But
but I know it when I see it.
Oh, yeah, baby. It's there. It has to do with a re-narration of and a reorientation of man away from transcendence as it was traditionally understood, I think. And so, you know, you see this, for example, in the turn away from providence and towards history. So the development of history as we currently know it is a major piece of it in romanticism.
I'm getting some Carl Loewith vibes from you, Colin. Do you know that Loewith, that meaning in history book?
I have heard the name, but I have not read it. So. Okay.
You should read it. You're basically like, anyway, I think you'd like it.
Oh yeah. I mean, if he's correct, you know, then he agrees with me.
If he's correct, then you'll like him.
And I'll like him.
It sounds like he is.
I don't like new thoughts, Hansi. I just want to.
Okay. So the turn from history. So that's why you hate Aristotle, right? Because the people who use Aristotle in Christian theology are clearly innovative. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Okay, but so it's like turn away from providence, turn towards history.
I think that's one of the major moves. I don't know. Do you want to identify any others? I mean, I think romanticism and you know the interest in and again going along with history, re-articulating and reimagining really the origins of humans and their nature. And you see this, it's tied up with this project of history and historicism. You know, you think about Rousseau, Hobbes, Locke, they're all Darwin, they're all retelling you about the origin of mankind and therefore telling you something different about what we are in our nature than what they classically would have said. And so you sort of your beginning, your end, the process of development of humanity and the reality that humanity sits inside of it. It's a whole way. So this is like the one place where I start getting, and now I'm a little off the Davenant reservation because, you know, hashtag wisdom, not worldview. I get it. I'm a good, please give us money. I'm a Davenant guy, but I can start feeling a little bit worldview-y when I start thinking about the difference between the ancients and the moderns.
No, I get that. So do you think that like technology, or maybe I should just ask, what role do you think technology, or maybe like, as Jacques Ellul would put it, the technological society plays
it's huge
in modernity.
It's huge. And it has to do. So, you know, one way that I've recently been expressing this to my students is that, you know, we all look at the ancient world and we say no to it. We look at it and we think these people are backwards. They're unethical, blah, blah, blah. What we don't realize, but what you can realize if you study them very closely, is that they looked at our world. They knew our world was possible. They talked about it and they said no to it. They rejected it. So what's changed is not the human capacity for technology or the use of technology to alleviate our, you know, daily needs or whatever. But what has changed is a belief in the ability of our technical means to solve ultimate problems. And they did not think that that was ever going to be possible in antiquity or in Christianity. In antiquity, they're like, these are just our problems. You know, this is why Stoicism becomes the logical cashing out point for most philosophy, I think, in antiquity, because you have to sort of make peace with your own death. You know, the death of your family and friends, the end of your city, maybe another city will be born in the future. We don't really know. It doesn't really matter. Just kind of live the best, you know, do as well as you can, kid. Christianity, that's on God, right? There is a good city that's going to be made. We are going to live forever, but this is a theological truth. In modernity, we can harness our technical ability to live forever. Our civilization doesn't have to die. Your family and friends don't have to suffer. All we need to do is harness the technical means at our disposal. Maybe we can't return to our original nature, which was better than this. That's kind of the Rousseauian romantic position. But we can solve the problems that our technical abilities have brought on ourselves through a fuller understanding of technical ability and advancing of it. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, that's my take on the modernity stuff. You guys have other...
Reese, you've got thoughts?
Yeah, I think the technology side of it ties into a way I've found helpful to think about modernity, which in many ways I have gleaned from our venerable colleague Joseph Minnick, which is to think about modernity from a phenomenological perspective. So what is it like to be in the world as a modern person, and how is that arguably substantially different from anything that people experienced before? So Joe, in his book with Davin and Press, Enduring Divine Absence, and then at more length in his new book, Bulwarks of Unbelief, which is with Lex and Press, go get it. We'll talk about something like, you know, what's it like to stand and look up at the stars for us now? And how is that different from what it was like for what we would call pre-modern people? And something Lewis talks about, where Joe gets it from, you know, in the pre-modern world, supposedly when you stood there and looked up at the stars, you had a phenomenological experience of height. The stars are high above you because you believe, you know, ultimately you're in a universe which, you know, metaphorically, God is high above us. We are, you know, further down the ladder down here, and the stars are placed high above us sort of to communicate to us about, you know, God's height above us. Whereas now we look out not into the heavens and experience height, but we look out into space and experience distance. Which is a much more kind of cold and less designed kind of experience. So I've found that a helpful way of thinking about it. And then one of the points that obviously wants to jump in, someone said one of the features of modernity is that it's just not modernity, and we sort of uniquely define ourselves by just being not what the you know, backward peasants used to be before things became modern. I think is true and untrue. You know, when you've had great kind of breaks and new ages and new empires and new rulers in the past, they have taken great lengths to establish themselves as being a new thing. We are in this new exciting age of republic or empire or whatever it might be. But they've done that at the same time as very consciously tying themselves into what's come before. And wanting to legitimize themselves, you know, with the War of the Roses in England, everyone wants to kind of, you know, tie themselves back to Edward III, whose offspring are responsible for the War of the Roses, and claim, you know, we're the legitimacy, and that takes us back to Arthur, and then that takes us back to Rome, and then Rome, you know, in the Aeneid wants to tie itself back to being Troy. And so, you know, there is acknowledgement of this is a new glorious age, new things are happening, but it's always trying to legitimize itself with something that's come before, and I think modernity loses the latter part.
Yeah. There's a great scene in No Country for Old Men. I'm a huge Cormac McCarthy fan. Folks on the podcast probably know that. We've talked about it a number of times. Great scene that I think depicts the ancients and the moderns perfectly. So the sheriff goes to visit his like cousin or something who used to be a sheriff, you know, out in the countryside. Sort of, this is one of the climactic scenes in the brilliant film. And he walks in and he says, you know, he's thinking about retirement. I'm thinking about quitting. And the guy says, why are you going to do that? He says, you know, I thought when I was a younger man, at some point, God was just going to come into my life. But now I think he just doesn't care about me. Something like this. Yeah. And the guy says, you don't know that. And he says, it ain't all waiting on you. That is vanity. Okay, so the guy who's sort of like, oh, I've got to just do all the things, and I just, God has abandoned me, and blah blah blah. This is modernity, you know, in a nutshell. Go watch the scene; it's brilliant. And then this, you know, crippled guy who's clearly really suffered. He's living in this completely disgusting place. He's like lost both of his legs, and I think he's probably blind. He's in a wheelchair, And he's sitting there being like, no, that's vanity. God loves you. And, you know, that's just it. It's like, you know, their lives might look miserable to us, but in a strange sense, I think they were at least as close to happiness. Let's put it that way. And I think there's a fair bit of evidence that in many cases they were far closer. We had two questions about fairy tales, and we're probably running up against pretty close to the limit here.
Okay, well, if fairy tales is what we have to go to next, I'm going to start talking about modernity again. No, I'm teasing. But,
clearly, the listeners want to hear your thoughts on fairy tales, Anzi.
No, we've already subjected him to Lewis, so we've got no fairy tales.
No, you guys are going to get yourselves canceled if I start mouthing off about fairy tales and Lewis in one podcast. So you take us to fairy tales, Colin, and I will listen to the sounds.
Well, we did an aliens voices. Episode. Why not a fairy tales episode? We'll start with that one. Anzi, you can answer that clearly because you hate joy.
Why not a fairies episode? I mean, you know, this is actually something that's really interesting. Something I know almost nothing about fairies, like sort of historically, like how fairies were considered and so forth. One of the things that's really interesting that Jason Josephson Storm raises in his book, The Myth of Disenchantment, is that, you know, when there's all of this literature that pops up in like the 17th, I mean, it goes back for a long time, but it like really sort of hits a fever pitch in like the 17th, 18th centuries about the fairies leaving England, mm-hmm. right? Does that sound right? I can't remember if I'm remembering this right. Or I don't know if I'm remembering it right. But the fairies leaving England. And one of the things that he points out is like for a very long time, this was treated as sort of flowery metaphorical language by like later readers of all of this literature. And Storm just says, well, no, what if they actually thought the fairies left? Mm. And so one of the only thing that I would that I have to say about fairies, it sort of goes into the, it sort of is connected to broader conversations about enchantment, disenchantment, so forth. The only thing I would say is that for whatever reason, every era thinks that it's less enchanted than the eras which preceded it. And I don't know what to make of that. I mean, you see this, we were talking about Hesiod earlier, you see this clear as day in The Works and Days. You know, I mean, Hesiod thinks, you see this in Homer, you know, I mean, you read the Iliad.
As Charles Taylor calls it, it's just obvious.
Lord of the Rings is the same.
In Homer, like Homer thinks that prior ages were more enchanted, right? I mean, it's like back when the gods regularly spoke to men, or back when a man could, you know, lift a whole boulder on his own and hurl, you know, I mean, so you have this like the giants and gods and stuff. And there was this time when like the world was just saturated with these things, and now it's not. And so one of the questions that I sort of have had in the back of my mind for months or years really is why is this feeling so persistent? Mm. Like, why do we all feel that the past was a place where there were dragons and fairies and gods sort of great people? And today we don't feel like that. But every prior age that we have for like basically all of recorded history feels the exact same way.
Yeah.
That like their predecessors were god, you know, there was a time when giants were walked the land, you know.
So the question is, why didn't they do podcast episodes on fairies?
Because they looked at our world and said no to it, Reese. They said no to podcasts. And I can see why, you know.
Were you going to say something else about...
you were putting me in mind of a similar phenomenon that always puzzles me, because you see it persistently. It doesn't matter what age you look at. Finding young people who experience nostalgia for the world that they didn't even experience. That's right. The weirdest thing. And that to me is like, this is where fairy tales come from, baby. I mean, mm-hmm. I honestly think it has something to do with that sort of like, there's a strange, I remember, you know, being like, you know, a 6-year-old and being like, oh yeah, but the world, and this is like, you know, it's like 1990, and I'm like, yeah, but the world in like, you know, 19, you know, 58. And you're like, what? What would you know about it? You don't know anything about it. You know, or I'll tell my kid, like, stories about the 90s.
What a time to be alive.
Yeah, and my kid will be like, oh, the 90s. Wow. You know, everything was just...
That is what they're like now. They all dress like it's the 90s again.
Right. It's like, you don't know anything about this. Why are you feeling nostalgic? You're young. Yeah. You've had no experience to feel nostalgic about.
Yeah. Right. Right.
So,
I mean, arguably part of the answer, you know, is that it's the world is full of spiritual beings who do stuff. But we basically don't really know much more than that. You know, the Bible sort of says stuff about angels, bizarrely. It just kind of assumes a lot about angels and whether seraphim and cherubim and whatever are different. It's just, I think we said this when we kind of came, when we talked about aliens with Joe Minnick
The aliens are the fairies, right? I mean, that's kind of one. So maybe we did.
The aliens are the fairies, or the fairies are the angels, or they're a different kind of angel. Like, we need to be deeply okay as Christians, I think, with the idea that there might be a whole sort of chamber of reality that exists that you just don't know anything about.
The Archon.
And God. Yeah, and every now and then you get a glimpse into, it's like my 4-year-old at the minute, the sun's out, it's warmer, so our neighbours are out in their gardens, their kids are playing, and she just always wants to like peek out the window at what the kid in the garden next door is doing. And she just says, Daddy, I wish I had someone to play with. And she plays with these kids all the time, but whenever she's not, she's like, I want to be over there doing things with them. And we're kind of like that with these other chambers of reality, you know. And I have to say to her, sweetheart, you've not been invited round, so you can't just invite yourself in there. And I think we need to feel a bit like that with all the sort of possible realms of spiritual reality. Like, you haven't been invited round. Maybe sometimes you are. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you overhear snippets of what's happening in the next garden, but it's not your garden.
Mm-hmm. That's a good word.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It's weird, though, because, I mean, this is not even just like a uniquely Western phenomenon. This feeling that, like, you've been cut off from... Like, there's this... Eliada has this, you know, talks about this in the context of a bunch of different kinds of myths. But there's also, and I was trying to like find the name of it, but there's this really interesting set of myths by this Native American tribe where instead of like a temporal distance from the gods, where it's like, it's not like it was, you know, the gods walked among us in the last, you know, generation or whatever. Mm-hmm. And now they don't. It's like it's a distance. It's like the gods are on the other side of the mountain, and we've been pushed to this side of the mountain, and we're cut off from them. And so, anyway, which is just another way of saying that, like, there are beings that you know act, and yet we feel cut off from them pretty much universally. And I don't know what that's all about.
And just one word on this, and then we'll move to what we're reading. But it's interesting to me whenever anyone tries to kind of write or depict a story in the Golden Age, where the gods and the monsters and the titans whatever are still kind of in their prime, it's usually really dull. arguably, you know, one of the reasons the Silmarillion, I will not say is dull, but will, I think, always defy adaptation, is because it just doesn't make for the kind of storytelling that we would really get us going. Or you get adaptations like there's a sort of spate of them of sort of Greek myth era movies of like the Clash of the Titans and all that kind of thing. And you get kind of prequels to, you know, legacy fantasy stuff set back in the kind of ages of dragons, whatever. And they're usually just really dull. Kind of doesn't have the stakes and the sense of, you know, ennui or whatever we're going to call it that, like you said, is just present in every other culture.
Yeah. Real quick, I found it. The myth, the tribe I'm thinking about is the Acoma Pueblo. Mm. So the they're sort of cosmic
friends of the show.
Friends of the show.
Yeah, but Eliada talks about the. He doesn't talk about them, but we read in college. I read a text about the Acoma Pueblo.
I think Rodriguez talked about this. I think he quotes Eliada and on that kind of thing and Enchantment a lot. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Eliada's great, but he's like, I think a lot of people, he was kind of like sort of Orthodox, like Eastern Orthodox. His wife was like very devout and pious. And so I think there's a kind of like, you know, a lot of his theorizing about religion basically winds up saying that like Eastern Orthodox conceptions of the liturgy are sort of the inchoate thing that every religion is doing. And then it sort of finds its, I mean, he doesn't quite say it that way, but I think he's a very insightful scholar, very unfashionable now because of his ties to fascism early in his life. But just a brilliant guy. So, all right, with that, gentlemen, what are you reading?
I just finished my semester and in the sort of Renaissance to early modern, you know, it kind of goes, it's like a crazy class. It starts at sort of the very end of the Middle Ages and goes through to the early modern period. And we ended with poetry selections from the Romantic period. And so, you know, we got to read Wordsworth and Shelley. And one of my favorites was She Walks in Beauty by Lord Byron, which is always kind of hard to place inside the Romantic school because it doesn't really touch on nature and it doesn't really touch on the sort of fall narrative that the Romantics get to. But then when you read it and you read it in context to these other ones, what you realize is that he's sort of getting to the logical end point rather than the beginning point of Romanticism, which is to use the technical means of human ability to finally fully satisfy humanity's desires. And so She Walks in Beauty is like his attempt at that. You read it and you're like, wow, she really does walk in beauty. Wow. But of course, nobody's like this. It's a complete fabrication. And so he's using the technical means of poesis to, you know, bamboozle you. It's a beautiful poem. And I get bamboozled every time I read it.
Hmm. Nice. Maurice, how about you?
I've actually been able to put aside some time to read a bit of fiction recently, which has been nice. I've been catching up on Haruki Murakami's last book. Have you guys ever read any Murakami? First person singular. So, you know, like me, Norwegian Wood is Murakami's big novel.
I think I read that one years ago.
Yeah, which oddly, it's actually in many ways the least representative of his. What he does. I wrote my undergrad dissertation on a Murakami novel. He's kind of Japanese magical realism.
Right. He wrote the one. Is the one that you're reading the one that made waves not too long ago about, you know, it's sort of like going backward and forward in time?
No, that's 1Q84.
Oh, yeah. That one I've.
Yeah, yeah. Which is it. That's mega. That's like two, three novels kind of slammed together. No, this is a collection of short stories of his. Part of his whole shtick, and you just got to get with it. If you don't like it, find and read him. But is that a lot? His protagonists are all generally the same: the sort of shiftless, aimless everymen who have mysterious encounters with women whose names they don't know, and then they talk in great detail about how they kind of are standing around in their kitchens cooking pasta and wearing tennis shoes, and then like a monkey climbs in through the window and starts to talk to them. Or a little man jumps out of a painting and tells them to get into a well under the ground and stuff like that.
Normal guy stuff. Yeah.
Normal guy stuff. Murakami is very much guy stuff. Very odd women that he encounters. His most recent collection of short stories. They're largely sort of about the first person singular. So there's a whole sort of unreliable narrator thing going on with, you know, how they remember things and the sort of weird things that stick in your memory for decades and you don't quite know why, and yet they still sort of just have the power to wreck you, like the memory of a girl running down the school corridor in 1963 clutching a Beatles LP with the lights down and things like that. One of the stories towards the end, it's all kind of been told in the first person singular, and then suddenly it goes like square bracket. Question, how do these two characters reuniting reflect on their similarities, something like that, and yet the whole thing is suddenly recast as a you know, self-consciously fictional piece of writing, which I don't know whether I thought that was just pretentious or undergraduate, but you know, I'm in for the whole Murakami shtick and I needed to catch up with his latest book, so yeah.
That's great. Nice. Well, I've been reading I was racking my brain for something that was like less, you know.
Oh no, Arabic. just say it. I know. But, this you're just gonna be saying I'm reading the hoofdy of
Geely. No. So actually, I'm reading a novel right now by it's the first Arab American novel published in English, I think, and it's called The Book of Khaled. It's by a guy named Amin Ilrihani.
I've heard of this.
Yeah, see. But yeah, so Amin Ilrihani. But he's a Syrian American writer in the early 20th century. There's this like group of they're almost all Christians because those were the people emigrating to the United States at the time. There's this group of like Syrian / Lebanese because Lebanon was you know Syria at the time. But like these Maronite mostly Maronite Christians in the early 20th century, just kind of like banging around New York, starting literary journals and writing novels and sort of political treatises. And Rihani is really interesting because he's writing in Arabic, but also in English. But the Book of Khaled is like this book about it's sort of like a fictional re-narration of his life, but about like a guy who comes to the United States as a boy and then begins yearning for like, you know, home. And so it's this interesting attempt to sort of like
reverse
synthesize
Orientalism in a certain sense, right?
I remember, we
went over this in like a class on Orientalism that I took once.
So Rihani is interesting to a lot of people because he basically accepts the Oriental Occidental binary, mm-hmm. but he also historicizes it. So he thinks that they're sort of like that basically one part of the world is always quote unquote Oriental mm-hmm. and another part is always quote unquote Occidental. And they sort of but this shifts from place to place. So like in the Middle Ages, it's the Muslims who are actually it's the Arabic world that's like Western and rational, and the Western medieval world is superstitious and blah blah blah. But he sort of works this into this Hegelian dialectic where these two sorts of dueling opposing forces are constantly producing higher modes of civilizational mm-hmm. existence, and he wants to like synthesize them. Anyway, it's really kind of interesting stuff. So that's what I've been reading. It's great. Would highly recommend it. He's got pretty good. I mean, for a guy who didn't you know learn to speak English until he was 11 or 12, his English prose is pretty good.
Nice.
So anyway,
that always blows my mind when you see these immigrants who just master the language and like are able to write in it, you know, better than anyone.
Nabokov is like the
Leo Strauss is another famous example.
Oh, really? I didn't really. I guess that
makes
sense.
He grew up
in
Germany, and then he was in France, and then like English was like his third language, or if not fourth or fifth, I don't know exactly. And he just is like the best.
I've never really read him. Is it Borges says like he even prefers English as a language to write in?
Yep. Borges wishes that he was a native English speaker so that he could have written his fiction in English.
Yeah. Rihani actually just made a very similar point in the novel, like where he talks about he thinks that languages, what's really important about a language is the verbs, mm-hmm. and Arabic really only has three real tenses, whereas English, you know, has like an infinite. And not infinite, but has just way more ways of expressing relations of action.
I mean, I really, I make this Arabic point. Does. One of the classes I just finished teaching is an English writing class, and I always make this point. Part of it is like you have to be an apologist for English because I feel like English gets such a bad rap in general. America, English, really, French, Latin, everybody's got some other language they think is more important, Chinese, right. We're going to make money, Germans, we're going to, be German. But in English, it really is a potentially infinite language because, mm-hmm. I mean, anytime you're dealing in the imperial language, you can do anything with it.
We talked about this when we had Ryan Hamill on ages ago talking about ancient language and whether specific languages truly lend themselves to different kinds of literary forms. And basically said, yes, the great legacy of English is blank verse because you can do so much with it.
I have no idea why Rihani thinks that like English has more verbs than Arabic has way more verbal. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is, I actually think he's wrong,
think he's wrong. That's the point. You told us when you were reading so that you could tell us and he's wrong.
About this very specific
he can look at their possible world and say no.
He walks in beauty like the night, ladies and gentlemen. Anzi Camel.
All right, moving on. Reese, what's the spotlight for this week?
So this episode will drop on Monday, the 22nd of May. And on this coming Thursday, the 25th of May, we have the last of this year's Fellows Lectures, Davenant Fellows Lectures. These are public lectures delivered on Zoom by some of the wonderful experts in the Davenant orbit. And we've got a visiting lecture this time, Dr. Chris Castaldo, friend of the Institute, who's written things for us in the past, on Italy's forgotten Reformation. Mm. So we look through Reformation history, and we can talk about great things in England, in France, in Switzerland, in Germany. Italy, however, you know, they've got the Pope sort of hanging around over there. Still there, I'm reliably informed. So we tend to think very little happened in the Reformation. Or if you hang around Davenant, you know, a little bit happened, and they had Peter Barter Vermigli, but of course he hightailed it out of there. Chris is going to deliver us a lecture on the forgotten Reformation in Italy. So we did a similar one earlier this year with Andrew Mesmer on Spain's forgotten Reformation, and it triggered us to host this. So this is on the Monday. Go on the Davenant Institute website. You'll be able to register for it there. Try and do that by Wednesday so that you can attend the lecture. But it will be uploaded to YouTube afterwards as well.
Dope. Thanks for that. And with that, if you liked what you heard today, which was even, I don't know, more off the cuff than what you normally hear, if you still liked it, give us a 5-star review. But if you didn't like it, Colin, what do they have to do?
You really, you know, you need to go to some sort of counseling or something, because you only have yourself to blame, because we were answering your questions. So if you didn't like this episode, don't give us a 1-star review. You know, think up better questions, send them to us. We'll do another one with better questions, and then you can give us a 5-star review. And that's what you could do this week.
I love it. I love it. Well, with that, we are the editors. This is the Ad Fontes podcast, and we will see you next week.